all things considered.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here in the studio today with Faye Weldon, the author of, most recently, The Cloning of Joanna May, but also of The Lives and Loves of a She-Devil, The Hearts and Minds of Men, collections of short stories, as well as a book of literary reflections on Jane Austen. And as really what seems to me the inventor of a new kind of comic novel, it's a pleasure to have you here. I figured I would ask the terrible question first. Are you a hellion?
I don't know what a hellion is.
A scourge from hell.
Well, I don't think so. No, I mean, I like to see myself as an angel from heaven, but then who does not?
These books have been amazing me for, I think, around 8 years now. Mostly because while they are immensely funny, they're extremely serious as well, taking on nothing less than the reformation of the race, if possible.
yes, that's my general ambition, I think, yes.
When did they start? When was the first published?
About 20 years ago. I was working in an advertising agency and writing television commercials, and then went on to write television dramas, and then thought, well, they keep changing these and shortening them, so if I wrote a novel, nobody would be able to interfere, so I started writing novels.
You do the supposedly unpardonable thing. You address the reader directly. My favorite direct address is the one in a short story where you say, if you remember this couple from before and remember that their child was a little girl and that I'm now saying it's a little boy, stop reading. Too bad.
Yes, well, I do think you can take literature a great deal too seriously, you know. I went to university, but I did economics, not English literature, so I was never told how to do it. I was never told there were rules. I just read, and I came from a family who wrote, and I don't think any of them knew there were any rules, and so it came quite naturally to me to do it. I mean, the dear reader trick, I mean, in a way it is a trick. It's a way of endearing yourself to your reader. I mean, mind you, they may hate you and not read anymore. But it works for some books. It is actually an easier way to write, and if it is seen as a sort of 18th century way of, I think, of writing. But I suspect any writer who writes a lot will pretty soon start saying, "Dear reader." Because that's what they're doing. So it's not a matter of sort of styles or convention. It's just what you do if you're trying to talk to people in this rather peculiar form, using words on a page instead of over the air.
When you read the early Evelyn Waugh, I at least get the feeling that, God, he's making it up as it goes along. Not that he is, but that he's mastered effortlessness. And after that, it seems to me that you're the next effortless writer. I remember that there's a quote in Dickens, in Great Expectations, where Joe Gargery says of a little epitaph he put on the tomb of his father, he said, "I made it myself. It was as easy as rounding a nail." And since he's a blacksmith, it was in fact easy. And these books seem lickety-split in their, you know, frictionlessness and effortlessness. I'm sure it doesn't come easy. How did you get your tone?
I think the whole art is making it appear effortless. In fact, quite I do a lot of redrafting and rewriting. And as you go on writing, I mean, what you do is you try and engage somehow more and more complex things and ideas, because you then have developed the craft, if you like, of getting these ideas out of your head onto the page. The first novels are really quite simple, but they still seem effortless, I hope fairly effortless. But as you go on, you, as it were, use use your an increasing accomplishment, render more and more complex ideas still effortless. And this is really what I would see as my object. Thank you for noticing.
The books have become more recently sort of science fiction-y in their invention. Characters who change their bodies, or in the case of The Coning of Joanna May, just published by Viking, one of the characters, the leading lady, Joanna May, discovers in the course of the novel that she has 4 clones. She's never had children, and their presence in the world at different parts of England are a surprise to her. That kind of audacity, has it come later on?
Yes, I think you almost decide that the kind of practicalities of the real world, or kind of domesticity, begin to pall rather, and so you venture out. I mean, let me say that it's really not science fiction. It is, if anything, science speculation. I think these things are happening all around us, and we like to think it's science fiction because we don't quite want to take it all on board or discover really what... I mean, we have to eventually think about our own notions of identity or what I is or who or what or where we are, a subject which human race is very reluctant to address itself to. So in a way, I move out. I don't think I move forward into time, but really you have to encompass, I feel, in the end, rather more than I used to.
This book seems, more than some of the others at least, to be an attack on technology, or at least the technology that's accountable for Chernobyl.
Well, you see, I'm not really. I'm not dead set against these things. I'm not dead set against technology. I disapprove heartily of nature, and I think leaving birth to magic or instinct or natural forces, which is what we do at the moment, is a crazy way for us to go on. So, I'm not against genetic technology. I can see it has its problems. I can see that the people who are doing it are probably not particularly well motivated, or indeed crazy, like Carl May, who seems to be doing it all. Nevertheless, the thing in itself isn't. You can't just assume that because it's modern, new, and male, mostly it's bad.
Carl May, who is the head of Britnuke, I think it's called in the
yes.
book, is a kind of Wagnerian male. He's a Prometheus who brings to the British Isles every imaginable ill, beginning with his claim that the British nuclear power plants are not the same as the Russian ones, and what happened at Chernobyl won't happen here, when, of course, at least here, those of us who've read Marilyn Robinson's book Mother Country are well aware of the nuclear pollution of the sea and the enormity of the difficulty in dealing with radioactive materials in England. Is there a model for that figure? He just seems so maleficent.
Oh, yes, indeed. He's an amalgam of many figures, but I hear that said all the time, of course, our nuclear power plants aren't like that one. Those are Russians. Those are nasty, old-fashioned things. Ours are good nuclear power plants. self-delusion knows no bounds, and the head of our electricity generating board is known to stand up in front of television cameras and drink the water from cooling ponds to prove that...
Oh, that's actual.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, yes, great publicity people. We have great publicity stunts we do, because there is a kind of feeling, you see, that it's that nuclear radiation is a bit like aspirin, and a little will do you good. It has a slight tonic effect, and a little more won't do you much good. But if you really take too much, then it will kill you. But, you know, a little has a gentle tonic effect. And there is a kind of general feeling, and for all I know, they're right. I mean, let us not suppose, really, that let us not be so blithe in supposing that the human race is going to be able to go on into the future without nuclear energy of some form, because I suspect, unless we all change our habits and refuse to use electricity, we will have to use this form of power because of all the other allied terrible things like ozone and things we need or don't need, depending where we are.
Pynchon, somewhere in Gravity's Rainbow, makes a speculation that's in a way borne out by the thread implicit in the end of the cloning of Joanna May. He says, suppose we don't know it, but suppose those people, the ones with all the power, suppose they don't die. Maybe they clone themselves, he says, maybe they refrigerate themselves, but perhaps we don't know it, but they stay alive. They own us. This book takes that frightening premise literally.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? But mind you see, there is a glimmer of hope there, because perhaps if his wife actually does bring him up as a baby, which is what she does, she might make a better job of it than his mother, because we all know mothers are to blame for everything.
Well, his mother had kept him...
Yes, his mother was insane, yes. Kept him in a kennel.
Yes, with the dogs.
With the dogs, yes. And he partook slightly of the nature of dog when he grew up, and perhaps for that he's not to be totally blamed.
Do you draw the line anywhere? Are there places where the outrageousness of the books surprise you? I didn't know I was about to do that, and you draw back?
They're not so out of control as all that. I think if you get all the threads and the characters and the events all working properly together and true to some kind of natural order in the real world, then they do resolve themselves in a very satisfactory, though somehow surprising, way. But I hope I do not outrage people's sensibilities in real areas. I hope I don't stand between them and their relationship with God, or I hope I don't stand between them and their relationship to the having of babies. I don't kill children in novels. The children are often, not really nice, which seems to upset people.
Well, no one seems to be particularly nice in these books.
Nobody in real life is particularly nice, but you hope that they're entertaining. Do you know, the trouble with good people is that they're so very boring and not proper subjects for novels, are they?
I've wondered, do you think that fiction can, in any way, change the way people think about the world, change things for the better?
It's the only thing we have, is fiction, is ideas of these alternative realities in which you speculate on the nature of your existence, or the nature, indeed, of what morality is, or what is good or what is bad. Otherwise, all you ever know is the people you meet. It's only through fiction that you develop empathy, you work out what it is like to be in somebody else's skin, and this seems to me the whole point and purpose of it and why people read it. So yes, I think it is almost the only way. Information doesn't do it. It is almost the only way we have, whether it's the worst soap opera on telly or moving off into Pynchon land, it's the only way we have of finding out what we are. Profoundly important.
I found myself thinking as I finished this book that perhaps now we have a generation coming into their teens, well, 16, 17, 18 years old, who've grown up with the feminism of the 70s. Do you think it has made a difference in the way that children are being raised now?
Oh, of course it has. Yes, it has. Well, in some parts of the community it has, in the really traditional parts. No, it goes on. Much that is before. I don't know how much it is the ideas that have seeped through, or how much it is just the economic power of women that gives them more freedom, and they don't have to put up with as much as they did. But yes, in England, certainly, men go shopping and carry their babies around, and this 20 years ago was unheard of or unthought of. A few would do it, but it's, men are not ashamed to be fathers, and I think this is one of the most important things we now have. I think the Americans have always been much, much better fathers than the British ever have been. A fact that is acknowledged.
These books do their job in a kind of agitprop way. They raise extremely contemporary issues, and so these novels provide a kind of social history. They are so fantastic and so funny. If people were trying to reconstruct the world and what they had was the Fay Weldon oeuvre, what do you think that they'd come up with? What would that place sound like?
I think it would sound pretty much like it is, like it was, like it has been over the last 20 years. I don't know, because it's my vision of it, but I mean, I may not be right. Other people have other visions of it. I mean, there's such a kind of mass of reality, if you like, out there from which you take your pick. You see your particular vision of it, and some other writer would have another vision, but I reckon mine's right, or I wouldn't do it.
Who are the writers who've been most influential on you?
Well, odd that you should mention war, because I suppose, I mean, ask that question, I find it, I mean, I tend to, you know, I would rather deny that any writer had any influence on me at all, that I sprung, as it were, fully formed from out of nowhere. But I think, if I'm obliged to speak the truth, I would say Wells, Shaw, War, Huxley, and Hans Christian Andersen.
Oh, that's a wonderful list. That really is terrific.
I went to, I was in Denmark recently, and I went to the, as he's called, O.C. Andersen. You've got to get used to that museum. Oh, Hans Christian Andersen to us. And I hadn't realized this until I was listening to one of those little tapes that they have in such places now, and it was of Laurence Olivier reading the story of the little red hen, and I realized my style, and I realized where it came from. Well, certainly in the early books, with the look or the listen, do you know, and then this kind of parable of real life, which is actually, and in Hans Christian Andersen, often extremely painful, not for children at all, but yet told in this very acute way, which brings even the behaviour of tin soldiers is somehow likened to the behaviour of people in the real world.
From what he reads, he was an incredibly peculiar man, Hans Christian Andersen.
Yes.
Seemed to have been ashamed of the size of his chest and to have stuffed newspapers under his shirt front to look more commanding.
I think he was certainly a vain, neurotic man. He went to stay with the Dickenses, and Mrs. Dickens, when he left, was to have remarked, "Thank God he has gone."
You know, there is one thing that may be entirely off the wall, but did come to my mind when I was reading, especially the subject of baby stealing and kidnapping, and that's Elizabeth Bowen, who,
yes,
in her final books, like Eva Trout,
yes,
started having sort of nefarious plots and conspiracies built around the novels, very peculiarly integrated, and came as a big surprise to me because I, you know, was familiar with the Bowen of Death of the Heart.
I don't think I've read those. I don't think I've read those later ones. I must do so. How interesting.
Take a look. Eva,
yes,
Trout is, I don't know that you can call it a resolved novel, but there are so many eccentricities in it that it starts to be the kind of novel that takes itself apart, sort of the way yours do when they start talking to you that way.
I think you get almost fed up with writing conventional novels. What is a resolved novel, by the way?
A resolved novel where all of the gear feel in place and everything now fits together. I think of a resolved novel when, for instance, the cats that start showing up in Joanna May have a function, and eventually we feel, now that was nicely done, very,
yes,
well engineered. But then there's the writer who will throw things in and never use them again for the sheer perversity of it, and sometimes it's delicious.
Yes. Yes, it's more random. It's as life is, I suppose, which is full of random event. But I always disapprove of that, rather. I think real life is different from fiction, and the whole point, the whole reason people want to read fiction is for, in fact, this resolution in which everything has at least, it has a kind of beginning, a middle, or an end. I mean, you may do them in reverse order, but the point is that there is no randomness, which is why you've got to be very careful with coincidence. Coincidence happens in real life all the time. Readers these days object to it, and I think, in a way, with good with good reason. I think they would be at a loss to say why they didn't like it, and readers and writers would be at a loss to say why they didn't. They felt they were cheating if they used it, and I think it just is this sense of fiction as putting, of giving a purpose and a meaning to what is random.
It is interesting to think of your work, some of it, as being influenced by fairy tales, because then the truly horrific events seem a little bit safer.
Yes, but you see, fairy tales, you see, Hans Christian Andersen, they weren't fairy tales. They don't come out of this very strange tradition in which we're meant to find reason and meaning and purpose, but I don't. I don't see the significance of them. I suppose you can work hard at Red Riding Hood if you're lucky, and of all the hundreds and thousands of fairy tales, in that one you will find some kind of Freudian rationale, but most of them seem to me to be random, to be about the resonance of language, to be a whole succession of people handing them down in an oral tradition, getting them wrong every time. But Hans Christian Andersen are composed. They're seen as fairy tales because they have that strange sort of fairy tale lilt to them, and because they will deal with tin soldiers, and because they border on something that's both bizarre and yet has a profound meaning, and they are probably the fairy tales that ought to have been written but weren't.
Of literary fairy tales, I think my favorites are the ones by E.T.A. Hoffman because they are so strange. For instance, I think I've mentioned it on the show before, but in The Sandman, the child who's told that the Sandman comes at night to take the eyes of children who are awake, and he puts them in his bag, and he takes them to the moon, and he feeds them to the moon owls who gnaw on them.
But this is horrific. This is I think something should not be given to children.
What are you working on now?
I finished another novel called Darcy's Utopia.
Darcy's Utopia?
Darcy's Utopia. God help me.
What will happen there? I can't wait.
It's a very difficult novel to put in a nutshell. I haven't yet tried, really. It takes the form of an interview, which...
Uh-oh.
of a rather scandalous woman. By two journalists, and one journalist is writing up her views on a future of utopia, and the other is writing her life story for a woman's magazine. And they're having a relationship. God knows what this novel is about, really. I suppose about politics, sex, God and the devil. The devil puts in an appearance, and there's a sort of black magic curse running through it. But the curse is in people's heads, you feel, rather than anything real. But if it's in your head, it might as well be real, is my thesis.
We've been talking to Faye Weldon, the author most recently of The Cloning of Joanna May. I wanted to ask you before we end whether, if there were one thing, just one, that could be changed at a stroke by a special convention of angels who came to Faye Weldon and said, "You're a big boss of the world in your novels. If you could change only one thing in the real world, what would it be?"
I think we're going to run this world without money.
Oh, that's a good one.
Do you want me to expand on
would
that?
Would you?
Well, I think, Darcy's Utopia involves this theme, really, mind you. The people who espouse this notion end up in prison because it has such devastating effects. But I think, in fact, we will probably eventually have to learn to do without it because it has ceased. Money has ceased to be the means of exchange. Other things now do instead. And that instead of you can go into whole realms of hyperinflation, in fact, quite safely if you organize it properly. But inflation has become the great bugbear of Western societies, and probably quite wrongly. So, do you know, I started out my life doing economics, and some sort of fictional element enters into all this, I suppose, and you begin to project ahead and see that the world, in spite of the good intentions, and I do believe in those on the whole of those who run it or try to organise it, founder all the time on concepts, on money as a concept, really, rather than as an actual thing. Change that concept and you might end up with a much more just society in which wealth and wealth, education, knowledge, medical care, everything was in fact fairly distributed, as it never will be if we continue to rely upon this daft notion we've developed that these little bits of paper actually represent anything at all.
I remember that John Hawkes, when asked why in his novels he treated women so badly, he answered, "Well, I think I treat men every bit as poorly. I don't think anyone gets off very well." I've been surprised in reviews of your book when people describe you as a constantly chastising author of the men in the book, simply because the women, too, seem to be so full of malice.
No, it's not malice. They're not full of malice. They just wish to have a good time, I think, and so do the men. But alas, the interests of men and women and children don't coincide. They overlap, but they don't coincide, which is where all the tension comes from. This is not malice. This is just, I'm afraid, the facing of a very uncomfortable fact, that the notion that two and two make one takes a man and a woman to make a baby. It causes the most appalling. It's unjust for one. Anyway, it will never be fair. But I think what happens in this is really that the whole habit of literature always has been, and theatre and so forth, is that men are central and women on the periphery, that men act, women react. Now, I fortuitously, really, because I was brought up in a household of all women and never met men and went to an all-girls school and really hardly ever encountered a male until I was 19, I believed the world to be female. Therefore, it's quite natural for me to have women central, women acting and men reacting. Now, when and this still, rather less than it did, but it still strikes people as odd. Women find it very gratifying, again without quite knowing why, but men resisted and resented, feel slighted and sort of put upon, because they're sort of usually flung out of the books fairly early on. This may well be unjust of me, but you know, writers of fiction don't actually have to be fair. Do they? I mean, nobody.
Neither
you're not,
does anyone else.
No. Well, I think in real life perhaps you should try to be, but I don't think, you know, women writers in particular are expected to stand up for the male sex as well as their own, you know.
We've been talking to Faye Weldon, author most recently of The Coning of Joanna May from Viking. It's been a pleasure to have you with us.
And good to talk to you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, mouse.